This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Flip through the newspaper, and there is a barrage of numbers. Over the weekend, the year-long homicide toll in Baltimore City rose by 5 to a total of 174. One seems to happen every day. Of course, so do atrocities in Iraq. Yesterday, a bomb in the northern city of Kirkuk killed almost 80. Add a couple of zeros, and you'll get the number dead from starvation and murder in Darfur. Intellectually, we all understand the horror behind those numbers, but after a while, we just don't seem to react. It's difficult, but only human, to be numbed. As the scale of the tragedy grows, the numbers climb, the emotional distance only seems to grow. People make sense of it in different ways, and comparison may just complicate things. Later in this hour, Buffy is back once more with some serious feeling. But first, numbed by numbers. As you read the news or hear reports from places like Baltimore, Baghdad, or Darfur, do you shut down? Now, if you're an activist, how do you keep it going? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now is the public editor of the Baltimore Sun, Paul Moore. He joins us from the newspaper studios there in Baltimore. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
And it's been a bad summer for homicide in your city, and the Sun's editor has made a decision to try to connect their readers to crime in ways that the crime both seemed out of control and in some ways out of mind as well.
Well, Baltimore has a history of a perennial high murder rate, but it's obviously grown this summer. It's on pace to pass the figure 300, which is sort of a watershed number, which was achieved last in the 1990s. Because of the proliferation of reporting about crime, whether it be murder or other forms of criminal activity, the newspaper does use a certain amount of resources every day to such a problem, but there have been some very different approaches recently, and that's what I wrote about recently.
And describe some of them for you. I know one is a daily box that lists the number of murders.
Well, it is every day on what's known as the Maryland section front, which is your standard metro page for a metropolitan newspaper. As you mentioned in your intro, it's now 174. It's listed under the count homicides since January 1st. It includes a short synopsis of the latest murder case and information about it. That in itself, in my opinion, is an interesting and risky venture. But I think at this point, the editors have decided that not to put it front and center in front of our readers is just not responsible. It's part of our mission as an institution in this city to keep not only people informed and yet we have to recognize, as you pointed out at the beginning, that there is a numbing factor to numbers, whether it is Darfur or Baltimore or Iraq.
And risky because it risks alienating readers, not only readers, but advertisers as well, and business interests.
Well, I think to some degree, the business, of course, is changing, and that's another story for another time. But certainly perception is a very important part of living in a city like Baltimore and the surrounding region. The quality of life that people ascertain to in this city, there's a great psychological effect on the lives of the citizens. As my reporting and certainly the reporting of the newspaper itself, that this is an urban environment that is on the upswing. It's a great city with a lot of wonderful opportunities, but it is also a city with significant social problems. You're trying to find the balance. Mm-hmm. You run the risk of being too alarmist and possibly driving readers into the corner. But this is the ongoing debate at this point in time here at The Sun.
And it's not just this box, but a series of articles as well that try to put this both in terms of both more broadly and in more depth.
Yes, and actually, since I wrote my column, which appeared in the Sunday paper, there's been two more pieces of some note The Sun commissioned an independent poll to ascertain from citizens of Baltimore what the most important issues are. And astonishingly, 68% said crime, dwarfing education, which is more traditionally up near the top. I think some of this is incremental and anecdotal in terms of just the constant barrage. There is also a sense for some that television reporting, especially in a city like Baltimore, inflames it. But this particular story puts in some more perspective what people in this city are thinking about and are concerned about. We also had a story today about just sort of encapsulating the round of murders from the last weekend. And we try to put it in better perspective that the key figure for making sense of this is murders per 1,000 of population. And if you look at it, it's definitely up from the peak periods in the 90s, seeing Baltimore has lost some population.
And, of course, all of these. But it's a campaign in a way. Is the paper committed to sustaining it?
Well, I think they are. I mean, again, you can argue that any newspaper has to pay attention to things that are going on in its community that can appear on the surface divisive and difficult to handle. This is the job of journalists. What we're trying to do, and I'm not a spokesman for the paper, but I certainly pay attention to it. It's part of my job to analyze it, is to put as many resources as possible and moving quickly to be aggressive and finding things out. We are also in the middle of a political campaign. A new mayor will be elected, or at least our current mayor is running again. And so politics do play a role in this. So a number of sociological, political, and law enforcement factors tend to all emerge into one pot.
Want to get listeners involved in this conversation. Our guest is Paul Moore. He's the public editor for the Baltimore Sun. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Kevin. Kevin's on the line with us from Durham in North Carolina.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You know, I think the numbing effect that numbers have is pervasive in much of journalism. But what I find is frequently, when journalism tries to phrase those numbers in a way that makes sense, it always ends up making me suspect the numbers. For instance, every 3 seconds, a woman dies of a heart attack kind of summary. When that happens, I actually find myself disconnecting from the number even more as I start to question the means in which those numbers are derived.
You look at the calculation as opposed to the meaning.
Right.
Yeah.
It suddenly becomes trivia.
Yeah, Paul Moore, isn't that a risk? I mean, numbers are notoriously difficult to digest.
Oh, absolutely. And what we try to do is make some distinctions, and I think any newspaper does, in the actual text of news articles, whether it's online or in the published edition. You're trying to put some context, but you add as many valued numbers to it in terms of graphic. I'm going to throw something out here because it helps. When you talk about homicides in Baltimore, we published these numbers this morning. The victim of a homicide, the average arrest per victim is 10.8. The average arrest for a suspect in a homicide is 10.1. Do these numbers have value? I think it's somewhat on the eye of the beholder, but there are numbers like this that put into context sort of the environment that is involved in these crimes. To me, those are fairly startling and important numbers. Do they tell the whole picture? No. They tell a piece of it. But I'm interested in the caller's sense. Do those numbers have value for you, or would you reject those as well?
Kevin?
I think when they're not used in a broad sense, but really giving you a very specific sense of how that particular number impacts the situation, it is, but the generalizations or the analogies almost always have a sense, an effect of disconnecting me from the story at hand.
All right. Kevin, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's turn now. This is Dan, and Dan's with us from Naperville in Illinois.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wanted to make a comment that one of the things that it's kind of counterintuitive, but that connects me more to numbers and things like that are actually fiction, whether it's a story or whether it's a show like HBO's The Wire, which I'm sure Baltimore is doesn't love that much. However, it's stories like that that actually connect me more to it. It's the anti-reality that makes the reality more real. Hmm. And there's an absence of that coming out of the current situation in Iraq, and for obvious reasons, but I think that perhaps fiction coming out of that area would also give a greater sense of what's really happening. And I'll take my comment off the air.
All right, Dan, thanks very much. Not only The Wire, but sorry, in a way, a predecessor show, Homicide: Life on the Street.
I think The Wire is considered in this city an important barometer for life. David Simon, its creator, is a former Sun reporter a long time ago. And in many ways, yes, in terms of maybe the public relations nature of how you want to present yourself to tourism or so forth, but The Wire itself has done a terrific job, in my opinion, and I think those of a lot of us, that it's realistic and poignant and gets to some truths, I agree, that straight reporting can't achieve. So I think that just for that sense, Baltimore, it's part of the creative nature of this city, I think, and that people care about this community tremendously, and that The Wire is a great example of creative people in Baltimore creating a show that gets to things that ordinarily wouldn't be seen.
Yeah, and it certainly elevates it from the police blotter in a way. In a way, some of these Sun stories are trying to do some kinds of the same things, though with a higher standard of journalism, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. We're talking about how to keep from getting lost in the numbers when it comes to large-scale tragedies in a minute, the reasons why we get numb when it comes to all these numbers, and how it can keep us from getting involved. We'll get to more of your calls as well. 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can also send us email. Our address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. News stories are often told by numbers. Estimates of the number killed in Darfur, casualties in Iraq, murders in Baltimore or any big city. As the numbers grow, it can be harder and harder to connect to the scope of the tragedy. Today we're talking about why we tend to get numb to the numbers and what we can do to avoid it. Paul Moore is with us. He's the public editor of the Baltimore Sun. You can read about what his paper is doing to cut through the data and connect the readers with the numbers. There's a link to his article at npr.org/talk. And let us know, as you read the news or hear reports from places like Baltimore, Baghdad, or Darfur, do you get numbed by the sheer magnitude of the numbers? And if not, why not? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Ellen Peters is a senior research scientist at Decision Research. She studies judgment and decision-making and helped with the research in an article by her colleague Paul Slovic titled Numbed by Numbers that appeared in the magazine Foreign Policy. And she joins us now from her office in Eugene, Oregon. Thanks very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Neil. Thank you for inviting me.
And the research shows some interesting things about how we comprehend numbers.
It does, yeah. What we've been looking at is this idea that processing information related to a single person, it's fundamentally different from the sort of dry statistics that are often used in newspapers to convey the magnitude of in this case, the murders in Baltimore.
And one of the examples that was cited in the article was a case study where appeals were made for 8 children with some terrible disease or 1 child with that same terrible disease. And the fact is there was a lot more money raised for the 1 than for the 8.
That's correct, yeah. We've been talking about this idea of the collapse of compassion, that just simply because of some of our basic ways of processing information that are just part of our human nature, that when we're faced with a single identifiable person, that we feel more as we start to understand that person, and we react more in terms of those feelings, and as a result, we're much more likely to donate to a single individual than to 8. And we've, in fact, carried that a little bit further. We've decided to try to take a look at, is there a difference even between 1 versus 2? And we actually find, believe it or not, very similar results where people are much more likely to donate to 1 person. They'll donate more money than when you present them with 2 children.
Hmm. So the number where compassion fatigue begins to set in seems to be 2.
It seems to be 2. Isn't that unbelievable?
It is unbelievable, particularly when you see things like, I don't know, the reaction of the world to the tsunami a couple of years ago, where there was this great outpouring. It didn't last long, for the, admittedly, but a huge outpouring of compassion.
There was. And the thing is, people are very compassionate. It turns out that compassion gets elicited more, though, when you have single people, when you hear about the child and who's in need, or you see the family grouping, perhaps, if you can think about that as a single unit, and you find out a little bit about them, than when you tell them about the tens of thousands of people who are displaced by the flooding.
Mm-hmm. There's always been a sort of a correlation that, this had something to do with distance. The further away something happened, the more different the kinds of people to whom it happened, the less likely we were to feel compassion.
And I think that's similar. I think it's similar in this case. It's just that the distance away isn't space. Now it's emotional distance. I feel more when I'm faced with one person than with multiple. And because of those feelings, I'm much more likely to help, and I'm much more likely to notice it.
And it doesn't mean that large-scale atrocity fails to move us. You remember what used to be called, I guess, the CNN effect.
Oh, the CNN effect.
This was, the most outstanding example was the Kurds who were being oppressed by Saddam Hussein after the end of the first Gulf War. The United States, at that point, the first President Bush, had no interest in intervening in northern Iraq, but was more or less forced to by pictures of families suffering from starvation in the mountains of Iraq.
Right. And it was individual families, is my guess, what sort of led that to happen. It's sort of like the little girl, Jessica, who fell down a well many years ago. That one single child was much more likely to, in the pictures that came out of that, were much more likely to get people to do something than the fact that those wells and many other wells had been uncovered for many years.
Mm-hmm. And is there, in the research, is there any way to try to address this situation so that we can, balance the scale?
Well, I mean, one way of thinking about it is that the research is showing something very basic and very fundamental about how we process information, and it suggests that telling stories about people, telling about an individual child or an individual family is going to elicit more action from people. Hmm. And in fact, it's going to elicit more action than if you describe the single child or the single family plus the statistics, believe it or not.
Hmm.
So just the single story makes a difference. It also suggests, though, that because this is a basic and fundamental aspect of how we process information, that when we see something that's going on a more mass level, like the situation in Baltimore, perhaps, and certainly the situation in Darfur, that perhaps we need to take more legal remedies, that we have these single stories, but we know that there's this massive horrific thing that's happening, and that perhaps more legal action is needed from more of a governmental standpoint.
Hmm. Thanks very much. Alan Peters is a senior research scientist at Decision Research and joined us by phone from her office in Eugene, Oregon. I wonder, as you listen to that poll more, does that seem to click in with your perception of what's happening in Baltimore sometimes, that the more this happens, the number people get?
Well, I will say that substantial stories about individual cases are almost always going to resonate more. We had a case recently where a potential witness in a murder case was killed. There certainly does appear a strong tie-in to that case, and that was a incredibly powerful and disturbing story because it puts the criminal justice system also as part of the process. And I agree with Ms. Peters that yes, all of this is tied up with reporting about the system, whether it be law enforcement, the criminal justice system, and any number of things. So you can't just isolate, but certainly I would agree that stories about individual cases, whether they be murder or other crimes, that affect people or they can relate to, are more powerful than sort of longer stories about with numbers. I would agree with that.
Here's an email we got from Leanne in Chicago. I was a human rights worker in the Middle East, including Iraq, for about 4 years. In order to prevent ourselves from becoming numb, it was important to leave the conflict zone every 3 months. Otherwise, we would basically shut down and become part of the problem by becoming callous or traumatized. We also discovered the need to take rest, even during emergency settings. Otherwise, we would be too burned out to be helpful. And I think that something that may relate to some of the police in some of our inner cities as well. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Margaret's with us. Margaret calling us from Wichita in Kansas.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, my thought was timely for me because I was just thinking the other day, I was listening to a Robert Cray album I hadn't heard before, and it had a song on it called 20 that was about the war in Iraq, and it referenced being 2004 and the deaths that were occurring and young men dying and the reports to mothers. And I'm going to be 45 this year, and what hit me was that this is the longest war that's occurred in my adult life. I, as a child, you know, I heard about Vietnam every night on the news, but this is the, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I've gotten this far, and this is the longest type of involvement we've had, and it's still going on, and it's still the same story from 2004. So suddenly, it was very alive to me, not just by how many casualties there were, but how long this has occurred within my own life. It gave it a context for my own life, and I think that that sometimes makes a difference for people. How does it fit into the scope of how I understand my own life?
Mm-hmm. Yet sometimes the search for novel ways to think about things can lead us down twisted paths.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I'm a psychotherapist here, and I've worked with people around addictions, and sometimes getting people to get sensitive around that, around, you know, where they are in their addiction process, they will often look at, well, somebody else is so much worse. They've had four DUIs, and I've only had, you know, two or three, or, you know, I never lost my job, or something like that. And so then they think that they're okay because something is worse than them.
Hmm.
But if the numbers get closer at hand to them, I think, or it's like, okay, no, really, I am pretty out there, or other people think I'm really out there. Other people are going, man, I can't believe you. Then I think those numbers have a context that comes much closer to home if other people are looking at you as what stands out.
Interesting. Thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
Here's another email. This is from Simon in St. Paul, Minnesota. These numbers are daunting and hard to visualize, but sometimes they're just too broad and frankly boring. I've struggled in my advocacy career to get people to care about big tobacco, two jumbo jets worth of people die every day, or global child survival, a classroom of children dies every minute. The most effective jaw dropper I've come across, 6,000 dogs die from secondhand smoke each year. It's a new and novel statistic that shocks people more than the human tally. People realize how absurd that is, and it makes them think a little. Yet, Paul Moore, as I was just talking about, as reporters and editors keep trying to find new ways to tell these stories, the new ways themselves, it seems like you run out of ideas sometimes.
Well, new ways, I don't think it's probably not the most accurate way to put it. You're trying to find compelling ways, but yes, you're limited in the sense of the quality of the reporting is dependent a lot on getting into the neighborhoods, talking to people, and having a broad scope of all aspects of the problem, like I talked about before, criminal justice and government and policing and so forth. But I think it would be presumptuous of us as journalists to think that we're going to find extraordinarily novel ways. Online offers certain other opportunities, whether it be with multimedia and so forth, possibly to connect. But it still comes down to hard reporting, paying attention to detail, trying to understand the effect on individuals, paying attention to the overall things, and trying to write in a coherent way. Mm. And the number, as I've said, the homicide count number is only one tool in it, and there will not be a consensus in this newsroom and in this community that it is the best approach. But it is an approach that I think transcends ambivalence, and I think that's good. But you're right. There is not going to be any brilliant new forms. We're trying to use some of the tools that we have better.
It's one thing to read the newspaper as a layperson. There are people on the front lines of these intractable conflicts who deal with daunting numbers every day. Walker Gladden is one of them. He's youth coordinator at the Rose Street Community Center in Baltimore. He joins us now from the studios of member station WYPR in Baltimore. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
And you come at this from a couple of different angles. You yourself are a former convict who served some prison time, and you could have become one of those statistics, one of those numbers, and succumbed to hopelessness yourself.
Very easily. But what took place was there were people such as one of the directors of our program, Mr. Clayton,
mm-hmm.
Who saw a young man on the corner and realized that he didn't approach me in a negative way. Told me to, like, get off of the streets and don't do what you're doing. But he approached me in a way where as though that, first of all, he asked a question. Did I want to do something different with my life? And then when that question was asked, he also allowed me to realize that as I looked a little further, that there were opportunities there. So through that process, it allowed me to see and to make choices and realize that there were opportunity out there for me. And that process right there, just that interaction and that intervention during the course of what I was doing out there in those streets played a great part in my transition.
And so one person listening is aware to your story and realizing that everybody's story is different. Anyway, as we were saying, it's been a rough year in Baltimore. How Yes. do you keep working through all this stuff? How do you keep from becoming numb?
Well, one, I do appreciate the awakening. And one thing that we also do is we give back to our young people to the best of our ability. Right now, I've been working with the youth and our organization for over 7 years now. And one thing that we do is there's quite a few things that we do. We help our young people in terms of, just give you an example. For instance, we have about 35, maybe 40 young people in our community that live most of their time on the streets. We created a program where as though that we allow them to come in the morning time. They got to meet us 4 o'clock in the morning. They're able to make $20 a day. They come in and honestly, most of the youth that's out there, they come and meet us at 4 o'clock. They're up all night long. But the thing is, what's been created for them is an environment and also an opportunity for them to do something positive. And they run towards that opportunity wholeheartedly. So they meet us 4 o'clock in the morning, Monday through Friday, and they're there on time. And they're there within that environment. That environment is also an environment that creates a positive atmosphere. And it's an environment where as though that a lot of the young people that live in that community, in our community, what happened is that there's a lot of violence that take place in our community.
Yeah.
And when they come and join forces with us, they're able also not only to get $20, but also to settle a lot of the differences that they might have on the streets as well. So then we realize that what they really need on some level also is just one to be able to intercede on their behalf or intervene on their behalf in terms of a mediator to work out a lot of their differences.
We're so talking with Walker Gladden and also with us Paul Moore about numbers and how to deal with them. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I understand what your program is trying to do, Walker Gladden, but some of those kids you've dealt with, well, they don't come back because they've been injured in an incident, or some of them, I fear, may have even been killed. How do you deal yourself with the situation as you see these numbers mount around you?
Well, again, on the same borderlines, for instance, there was 5 homicides over the weekend.
Yeah.
And in the process of those 5 homicides, but within our community, there were homicides also right there in a portion in the community where we live on a regular basis. But because we created an environment where as though that it would help the young people and it would help them in a way where as though it actually helped reduce the violence in the community as well.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line before we have to go. This is Steve. Steve with us from Philadelphia.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question for Paul, I guess, in journalism ethics kind of a question. Yesterday's
sure.
Philadelphia Inquirer had a headline about, had a big picture at the top of the page above the fold of one of our latest shooting victims was a 14-year-old boy who was shot because he didn't get out of the street quick enough on his bicycle, and a driver shot him. And then underneath that, still above the fold, is a headline, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me, but the gist of the headline was that the victims frequently are carrying weapons themselves, and it almost seemed to me to be as if they were
blaming the victim,
not blaming the victims, but trying to make their white and suburban readers feel safe and with a chart inside showing where the neighborhoods
are. We're almost out of time, so Paul Moore, I wonder if you could get a quick reaction to that.
Well, without seeing it again, I don't want to comment too specifically, but if anybody could have got the implication that the 4-year-old somehow was armed and dangerous, obviously that would be very, very, very erroneous.
Unusual, if probably untrue.
Yes.
Paul Moore, thanks very much for your time. Steve, thanks very much for the call. Walker Gladden, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
And when we come back, belting out Buffy, our favorite vampire slayer, is back. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.